at DFI, you typically, you're not supposed to hit the kids. And I don't think that that's a good way of making them learn either. So we had no issues there. But for the first 6 months, these kids push every button because they're trying to say, where is your point after which you will hit me? In their head, you're going to hit me. You're saying all of this. There's no truth in it. You're going to hit me. I just have to figure out what that boundary is. But till they figure that boundary out, they put you through hell.
Hello there, and welcome to Ruben's Podcast, a show where I speak to people about their lives over the last decade and the lessons they've learned along the way. If you're new here, some quick notes before we get into today's episode. If you'd like to follow the podcast, you can find us on Instagram and subscribe to our newsletter. On Instagram, we are at Ruben's Podcast, and the newsletter is at rubenspodcast.substack. If you enjoy this episode and the podcast in general, you can consider supporting the show by buying me a coffee. But if that's too much, you can leave us a review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're listening to this. It makes me happy and helps the show reach more people. You can find all the links in the show notes. Okay, with that, let's get into today's conversation. Okay, awesome. We can start recording. Anya Thomas, yes. Welcome to Ruben's Podcast. How are you? It's 10 a.m. in London. Where in the world are you right now?
So I am currently based out of Nottingham, which is in the UK. It's about an hour and a half, 2 hours north of London. And I've been here for the last five months.
5 months. And yeah. You moved here from California.
I did. I moved from California where I'd been for the last 8 years. So it's a new year.
Why did you move? For work?
Mostly for work. It was mostly for work, but I think at some point I also had this little feeling in my head. I'm like, okay, I've been in the States for about close to 10 years. Do I like it here enough to like stay? Do I want to explore a little bit of what's out there? And then the teams that I worked with, my manager was always part of the UK business unit. So I've always been part of the UK business unit. So it was like, okay, if there's the opportunity to move to the UK, maybe I'll take it. And then there was also something to do with a visa in the US. Mm. So they were applying for the next Cardiff visa. And it was just like, okay, if you travel outside, it might be easier. So like everything put together, I was like, okay, maybe this is the time to just make that jump, you know? And I did. And unlike the US visa, which takes months and months and months, the UK visa takes about 2.5 weeks. Wow. And before I knew it, I was like, shit, it's done. Now I have to.
So you're here for good, or you're here just for a short period of time before you...
So right now my visa is for about 2 years. It's the work visa. So what I've decided is I'm going to give it 2 years, and then, you know, I'll figure out, do I like it enough here to stay? Do I want to go back to the States? Do I want to go somewhere else? Right now, the world is my oyster, which sounds like a very stupid way of saying it, but it's true.
And what has the scorecard been so far? It's been 5 months in the UK. What are you enjoying the most, and what are you enjoying the least?
Ooh, what do I enjoy the most is, the days off. I used to get 10 days off in the US. I get 25 here.
10 days off the entire year?
Yeah, that's a very normal. It's 10 business days is very normal for most American companies.
Oh my God.
That's very normal. And over here, it's 25. And weekends are respected. And just from a child, I like to travel. So from a travel aspect, it's been really good because Europe, like it used to take me, my parents just live in New York. So when I was in California, it would take me 6.5 hours just to get to them on a direct nonstop flight. Now in a 2-hour flight, like I'm in Switzerland. In a 3-hour flight, I'm in Spain, right? And it's way cheaper. Of course, the flip side of that is I can never rely on the flights. They're always getting canceled or delayed. And like I manage around that. I think from that aspect, just from the travel, from the culture, from the ease of being able to get around, I like that aspect. what's not worked so well is just, I think, the culture of getting shit done here. Like, it took me 2.5 weeks to set up my Wi-Fi. And that was, I was like, why is that a problem? And they were like, no, this is the normal time it takes. And I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? All you have to do is mail me a thing, like 2.5 weeks without Wi-Fi. Like, you can do it in a day in India. Forget about the US. You can do it in a day in India. So, like, just that kind of stuff. Like, you call anyone, it takes them a day to get back to you. Then they have a follow-up question. They just drag things out a lot. And that, it definitely stressed me out, especially when I moved, because I moved alone. So I'm in a new country. I'm settling in. It wasn't a new job. It was added responsibility and a promotion at an old job and at an existing company. So also I didn't get the whole, you're new, take a month to figure stuff out. It was like a, you know what to do, get on it right now. So I was, you know, doing that, setting up house, navigating through my stuff being shipped from California to the UK, which also got stuck in customs. So it took 3 months for my boxes to get here. So it was just all around. No. It was definitely a tough transition, for sure. It was nothing compared to the move from India to the US. So hopefully, I still have one box, which is over there. So after this,
I was just going to ask you, have you settled down? And the answer is probably not
for the most part, yes. For the most part, yes. There's like two boxes, which are both in front of me. And the agenda for today is do this call with Ruby, chill for a bit, and then get that shit. Because I am stressed out looking at them.
Oh, no. And this is you being 4 months already in the UK, 5 months now.
Yeah. So to be fair, in those 5 months, I think when I say I've been in the UK for 5 months, what I essentially mean is I've been paying rent here for 5 months. But I've had quite a few of my friends coming and I've been really making use of the whole travel thing. So this is actually the first weekend in about 4 weekends that I'm in my house. For the last 4 weekends, I've just been traveling Thursday to Tuesday every week. So or Thursday to Monday, or like a Friday to a Monday. So it's also been a little bit on me, where I haven't been like, okay, we're not going to do anything till we settle down. So
I see. Okay, so you're in Nottingham, an hour and a half north of London. You've been there for about 5 months now. So for people who, I mean, if you're listening to this, there's a high chance you already know Anya. But if you do not, Anya and I met, I think, back in 2010. Anya 2010, was 1 year. Yeah. 2010, which is September. We had September now. This was July 2010. So it's almost 13 years ago. This was back in university, in college. We both were in the same department. So we both studied economics. Anya was 1 year ahead of me. And I think just a quick summary, and Anya sent me this before we got started. After you graduated in 2012, you spent 2 years back in Chennai. That's like where you're originally from.
Yeah.
You were at Teach for India for two years. For people who remember Anya in college, you would remember her quite actively involved in the SSL evening class. I think she was like the only non-resi who would come for those classes in the evening. I wonder about that. There was this kid who was really, really fond of you. He's probably like, you're almost an adult now.
Do you remember that guy? Yeah. Some of the kids that I taught at TFI now have reached out, and I'm like, whoa, when did you get so old?
You did TFI for 2 years. You then essentially decided to go get an MBA. You went to the US. East Coast, so in Boston at Babson for 2 years. You then moved to California. You joined this company called UST Global, which we'll talk a little bit about. You've been with them for 7 years, and now you've essentially moved to the UK five, six months ago with the same company. And in today's episode, we're going to be talking a little bit about what Anya's, this journey over the last 10 years. I think a good place to maybe start, I was going to add an obnoxious joke about a sponsor, but I like chuck that.
Oh my lord.
But I think maybe we can start with time back in college. What's your favorite memory from your time at Stephens? It's almost been 10, 11 years since you graduated. You probably graduated in 2012. So that's a little over a decade. What was your favorite memory from your time back in at Stephens?
I think my favorite memory was just, I think we were lived in this little bubble. So, and what I mean by that, I mean that in a good way. So I know that, obviously everyone knows that Stephens was in DU, like right outside. Our college was, I felt like it was a different world, right? Like I've had family in Delhi. I've come to Delhi every summer since I was a little child. I never really, and I'm coming from the South, I used to never really feel safe in Delhi. It was always like, I always felt that, you know, from a safety angle, from just a cultural angle, it's very different from the South. But I felt like in Stephens, all of that was kept at the door. At the gate, you know, it didn't matter who you were, it changed. I never felt unsafe. I never felt like I had to be forced to fit into a clique. I think there was, the minute you walk into Stephens, and any college for that example, you automatically know that there are cliques. Right? There's the sports quota kids, there's the Delhi kids, there's the drama kids, there's the music kids, there's all of that, right? And I think I never felt that pressure to like, oh, you have to be in this clique versus that clique. I think I just found people who wanted to do the different things I did, and they may not always be the same people. So for example, like when I wanted to do the evening classes, I had you and I had Leon, I had Jerry and Didi, and like we had our group there, right? When I wanted to go shopping or like in Kamalanagar or like for economics, like for class stuff, I had Maria and Sneha and all of those, right? And then music was Chuck and like a whole other set of people. I just felt like I would always find somebody to do something that I wanted to do, and almost nothing was off limits. And I think it really shaped a lot of just me being very comfortable in who I was as a person. I think the foundation or the stepping stones for that was kind of set up in Stephens, because I just felt like, I may not be the coolest kid. I may not be, you know, the most popular kid, but I'm pretty safe and secure with who I am and the friends I have and, you know, what I am doing. So I think that was my favorite memory from Stephens.
Was that the case when you walked into college? Because I've spoken to some people in college and they're like, oh, like the first 2 weeks, 3 weeks is like intimidating because you suddenly see all of these other people. And they're like, oh my God. So like, was this like for you as soon as you walked in, or this eventually happened through the years?
I think when I first walked in, obviously on that first day, you don't know anybody, right? And like a lot of the kids who live in Delhi, I realized later that they came with a little bit of they had someone else to lean on because somebody or someone that they knew was going to Stephens. So they knew somebody to talk to. They had somebody to sit next to, you know? I didn't really have anybody like that, but I think on day one, you kind of, that first week, you're just making friends and everybody's there to make friends. So it's not too bad. And the first week you get a sense of, okay, who's from where? And I don't know if it was luck or, you know, it was just by design, but there was quite a few Malayalis from Chennai. And if you know anything about Malayalis from Chennai, we are always considered as no man's land. Yeah.
Okay.
We're too Tamilian for the Malayalis, but we're not we're not, well, Tamilians, you're Malayali, you're not like, so you, there's this little sect in the middle, right? So I think we just gravitated towards each other. And it so happened that we also enjoyed each other's personalities after that. We're like, okay, cool. Like I would hang out with you even not knowing you're from Chennai, you know? Maria was there, Sneha was there. And then those were the two in my class. And then I think in the seniors, they had Shruti Anakoshi was from there. So like the minute you, and then I slowly realized that we knew a lot of people, right? So for example, Marita had a school friend who actually, so before I came to Stephens, I actually went to Stella Maris for a week. And Marita's friend and I were classmates there for a week. So she and I had that connection. Benji's mom, Benji's from Delhi. Benji's mom and my mom had grown up in Delhi together. So like there was that connection. And you found those connections. Dia's cousin sister ended up marrying my family friends, marrying into the family of my family friend. So it was just all these weird things, which I don't know if they happened by design or they happened by association or whatever it is, right? Like, we eased into it a lot more. I think week one was definitely unnerving. But I don't think I read too much into that because I was like, okay, this is how it's going to be. Like, we'll get there.
But
in terms of just the being comfortable with myself, I think that was more of a slower, more of a gradual process. I don't think I walked in week one and I was like, yeah, I'm perfect and like, I'm great. No, I think for the first couple of weeks, I definitely struggled a lot, especially with the academic side of things. Like, I was a good student. I was always, you know, top of my class, always one of the, and I don't say this lightly, like, I was always one of the smartest kids because I made sure I read up on things. If I didn't know anything, I would read up on it. Always that way, 1 to 12. I come into Stephens and I was just, I remember some of the classes, I was so clueless. I was like, I have no clue what they're saying.
Like, which one was the hardest class?
Man, Raghu. I could never understand what he was saying. And I also, I don't know if it was him, I don't know if it was me, I think maybe it was a little bit of both, but I also felt like I wasn't comfortable enough to ask him questions. Like, I didn't feel comfortable enough to be like, I don't understand what you're saying. Can you, like, go a little slower? He was like, he would come in, he would da-da-da-da-da-da, okay, done. And I'm like, I haven't even taken my notebook out. Like, give me a second, right? So academically, Stephens was a big downer for me. Because I was like, I have no clue what I'm doing here. Maybe economics is not for me. I honestly feel like for me, and I think for quite a few people that I've spoken to and kept in touch with, like, especially when they came in to do economics at Stephens, they left Stephens going, yeah, I don't think I want to do economics. And I think a part of that could also be the way that I was taught or the professors that I have. Some of them were exceptional. Like Poonam Kalra, I remember her. She would take time off. And she would explain things to me. And I felt comfortable enough to go to her. Right? But, like, I could not say that for a lot of the professors.
Yeah. I really like ECO. Some subjects more than the others.
But you're fucking, what is that, Faridabad CBSE class top or something? You think I forgot it?
Not me. That was a small little town. By the way, I was just in Faridabad like 2 weeks ago. Oh my God, it's so like weird to go back there after all these years. But I really like the subject. But to be honest, like now, 10 years later, like I still, you know, I read a lot of, I won't say like academic economics, but like, you know, more like general, like macro and what is happening with the world and, you know, US. And I was like, wow, like a lot of this, like, you know, it's not rocket science. And, you know, we touched a little bit on these things when you were in college, but I wish somebody had spent more time, you know, going into the details of these things. And it is actually quite a lot of fun. It was not fun when we were in, like, at least most part of it, which is quite sad. But I think my biggest regret was, I won't say regret, but my biggest feedback, and if anybody who is studying economics in undergrad now, is like, we studied money, you know, we had an entire course called money. And then nobody really taught us like Bitcoin, right? And it doesn't matter if you care about crypto or not, but the fact that, you know, there was this thing which existed in 2013, which was, in my opinion, is very relevant as you're looking to understand money, you know, and the concept of money. And it was not even like touched upon. Somebody had like just at least planted that seed, if not just for understanding, you would have been like, at least I would have bought some Bitcoin, nothing else.
Yeah.
At that time. But yeah, it's
yeah. No, and I remember being a little disappointed by that, just that revelation that, hey, academically, I'm probably not going to get too much out of this. Because I remember thinking, I was like, I'm in the best college for economics. Like, if I don't expect it from here, where do I expect it from, you know?
Yeah.
So I think a lot of that, for sure. I think it was just, and there was, if anybody's listening, I'll just be like, you don't understand what's going on in class too much. I don't think both of the people on this call knew half of what was going on in those classes, and we still made it. So
You went and did a master's beyond that. Did you find it very different, or like what areas was the MBA experience very different from, at least purely from an academic lens, different from what you were doing at Stephens? Was it very different, or was it the same?
It was a full change. The way they would teach us, like, I got a lot out of my MBA. I think just the way we would go into these classes and they would try their level best to make sure everyone understood what was going on. Like, for example, there was two modules, a microeconomics and a macroeconomics module. And because my foundation in economics was strong, I crushed both of them. But I knew that there were people who'd come in from like a software background or an engineering background who had no clue what economics was, right? Like it wasn't a big deal in India when we were growing up. And I remember the teachers took so much time. They started from the basics. Like, think about it. Like, I know I was one of the younger ones, but most of my classmates were about the 20 to 29 mark. And my professor started from, you know, drawing the x-axis, y-axis, price curve, demand curve. She started from that basic level, you know? So it was just like, wow, she's really making an effort to make sure everybody understands what's going on. And that was the case with most of my classes. And I think except for that first semester, the rest of the semesters, you get to choose what you want to do. And I think in undergrad, yeah, you do get a little bit of choice in that. I think it's the second year that you start to get a little bit of choice, and the third year is where you actually get choice. But even then, you're kind of restricted by, okay, I have choice, but they're all in the economics field, right? If you're a history student, you have choice. Yeah, but they're all going to be history classes. When you go to B school, it's very different. I had a class on risk management. I actually willingly took a class on risk management, and my professor was amazing. If that man had been in my undergrad class, I'd have been like, fuck it, I'm going to do a PhD. I had a risk management class and I had a class on women's entrepreneurship. They're two very different disciplines, right? And I had a class on marketing for high-tech products. So they're three very different disciplines, but there was no question in terms of, you can't do all three. And I think that's just a big difference, not just from undergrad versus grad school. I think that's a big difference from how we typically used to approach academics in India versus how you approach academics in other countries.
Interesting. I think that's probably the only one of the few reasons I sometimes think that maybe I should go get a second degree, because I've not experienced what a non-Indian education would look like. But it doesn't justify the 100,000 price tag yet.
This is true.
Never say never. Anyway, so you right out of college, maybe we go back a little bit. Right out of college, you went to TFI. You spent 2 years there. In your voice note, you said that that was like a very important. You said it was very important for you, and you were very happy that you did it. I think for people who knew in college, it was quite logical on why you decided to do TFI. I think you really enjoyed just the whole evening class kind of thing. What was the TFI experience? Why was it such an important thing? And what did you love so much about it?
So I think when we were in third year is when you start looking at jobs, and I knew that I wanted to do something in the development phase. But also there was that little bit of a rat race. Like, I want to be at the Bains and I want to be at the McKinsey's and I want to earn this high pay package and I want to do all of that. But there was also always that development sector thing, because my father has been in the development sector for a very long time now. So it just felt like that I understood that space as well, which is why a lot of my extracurriculars also were around the whole children, the teaching, that aspect of things. And then I just got to a point where I'm like, okay, like, I do know that I want to get into a higher education in the next couple of years. This is a good opportunity because I can do this right now. And I can just go for it. I don't have to worry about the money aspect. The money can come later. And this came with a two-year deadline. And it was a two-year program. Okay. So I was like, okay, in a way, this is good because it'll also push me into, okay, 2 years is coming up. What's next? You got to be school. You start applying right now. I did worry, and I think in hindsight, I was right, because a lot of my friends have told me that they went into their corporate jobs thinking 2 years, I'm going to go into grad school. And then they stayed an extra year and an extra year and an extra year. And then finally they're like, okay, what's the point even right now? Right. So I'm glad that bet that I had taken then worked out. That was all of the reasons where I was like, all right, we're going to go the TFI route. In terms of why that was important, is I think it just gave me a very good perspective in terms of what matters in life, right? Like, so if you don't know what TFI is, TFI especially in Chennai, because when I joined, Chennai was the first year we were starting in that city. When you go to TFI Pune, when you go to TFI Bombay, those kids have had TFI teachers for the last 4 or 5 years. So you get a class that already knows how TFI functions. You get a school system, parents, a community who already knows how this starts. When we started in Chennai, it was insane. Nobody knew who TFI. They were like, what is TFI? You go in to teach these classes and they're like, are you going to be my teacher? Look at your skin. Your skin's so fair.
Before we go on, that's a good point. In case you do not, I realize I did not explain TFI, and some people might not know it. TFI stands for Teach for India. It's part of this global organization called, I think, which originally started off in America under the Teach for America label, wherein you basically have these bunch of people who join this organization and they take over schools, take over in the sense they essentially become teachers. And it's typically, you know, people who are after their undergrad, after their master's, who are trained to be like a teacher in K to 12, or is it lower? Primary school mainly.
Typically, they start primary. So they start from first, like third, fourth grade. But then it can go to lower and higher as well.
Okay. And yeah, typically, like, you know, people who join it work there for about 2 years, wherein you take on a class and you teach them over a period of 2 years. And I think what Anya was saying is in Chennai at the time when you joined TFI, there was no TFI before that. So it was the first year that you all were taking over a school.
Yeah, first cohort. Yeah, so you go into a school and they're like, who are you? How can you be my teacher? Like, you can't be my teacher. You look very different from what my teachers have been. Mm. You sound very different from what my teachers have been. You're at least 30, 40 years younger than what my teachers are. And a lot of, I think most of the schools in TFI, the classrooms that we had identified, most of the classes had 20 to 25 students, which is a healthy ratio. There was one school which had four classes, and each of those classes had about 45. Wow. And I was put in one of those schools. And even as a school, my co-teachers and I found it very difficult because all of the aids, all of the learning styles, everything that they were giving us was very catered from a 1:5 or 1:20. When I say five, because what you do is you put your kids in groups.
Yeah.
Right? So you have 25 kids, you put them in five groups of five, you're done.
Yeah.
If I did that with my 45 students, I'd have nine groups.
Yeah, 2x.
We didn't have space for all that, right? So it was very difficult because we also struggled with that aspect. Like, hey, the aids that we're supposed to be getting aren't really aiding our context. So we had to rely on each other a lot. And we really, truly did. Like, we were such a strong unit. And as a result, we became adept at... Because if my co-teacher is not well, I take care of her class as well. That's 80 students that I'm... We became so good at that. We were like 20 kids, not a problem. On one hand, we can take care of them. So that, you know, it made me so resilient to that. And then the more important aspect, I think I mentioned this before, was... Just in terms of what's really important, right? Like, some of these kids would come into school. They come from, you know, broken families. They come from abusive homes. They come from all of that. Now, don't get me wrong. Did I not know this occurred before that happened? Absolutely not. I did. But I was interacting with children who come from that. And when I say children, these are 8-year-olds. These are 9-year-olds. They look at you like you are God. Anything you say is fine, but that only comes later. So in every class, you'll have a bunch of kids. You have the good kids who are typically good. They don't cause a ruckus. You have the smart kids who, if you give them things to do and if you recognize them, they're happy. And you have the naughty ones, the ones who are just like, I'm gonna break you, right? And at TFI, you're not supposed to hit the kids. And I don't think that that's a good way of making them learn either. So we had no issues there. But for the first 6 months, these kids push every button because they're trying to say, where is your point after which you will hit me? In their head, you're going to hit me. You're saying all of this. There's no truth to it. You're going to hit me. I just have to figure out what that boundary is. But till they figure that boundary out, they put you through hell. Now, here's the thing. Again, going back, when you have 25 kids and five kids are being a ruckus, it's fine. You have 20 who are managing. it's very difficult when you have 45 kids and you're trying to manage the same thing.
Yeah.
Because 15 of your kids are causing you a ruckus, and ruckus being absolute nonsense. They would fight
Do you remember the craziest ruckus you experienced? Like, which brought you to the limit?
Oh, I think it was when I had just gone to take a lunch break. So you're encouraged not to have lunch with the kids. You're encouraged to let them be on their own, right? Mm. I think it was like 40 minutes. And we came back and two of them were fighting. One of them was crying. Somebody's shirt was torn off. Half the class was doing their own thing. Somebody came calling. Initially, they would keep coming and calling you for any small thing. She didn't give me my pencil. They would come and call you during lunch. She took my pen. She's crying. Come and call you. Like, there was this, I will call you for everything. They don't understand boundaries.
Mm.
Right? And the thing with little kids is they also don't understand consequences.
Mm.
Consequences for them last for up to a minute. So you tell them, don't talk or I will reduce 10 stars from your group. They will understand that and keep quiet for the next 1 minute. After that minute, they're back to doing that because their consequence doesn't last. As adults, your consequences last throughout, right? So it took us a long time, but it just gave me such a sense of, okay, this is important. You know, that pencil is what's most important to them.
Mm.
So now when I'm going into like the corporate world can be political, right? There's all kinds of things. There's all kinds of like, you know, when you're writing a proposal or you win a deal, somebody's like, yeah, my name was not called out. This was not called out. I think if I have survived for 8 years in a corporate company, I don't get involved in politics. I don't get involved in anything. I believe in the whole, I may not like you as a person, but I'll find a way to work with you thing. And I credit DFI for just helping me get a sense. Because I'll be able to take a step back and I'll just be like, this is not important. Like, what you're complaining about, like, these kind of problems where people are like, you know, like, I'm not being treated on a pedestal above in my head. I'm like, this is not even important to me. Like, this is not what we're here for. Just give me what I need from you and I can bounce. I credit TFI for a lot of that. For a lot of that.
Interesting. Do you think you'll ever go back to work? You've been in corporate for like 8 years now. Do you think you'll ever go back to work in a TFI-like organization?
No, and to be very honest, because I don't come from a very rich family, a job like TFI doesn't pay you. I want to be able to maintain a certain lifestyle. I know this is not the typical response, but like, to be very honest, like, TFI paid me nothing. I lived at home, so I didn't have to do, you know, my khacha pani on my own.
Yeah,
I lived at home. My mom and dad took care of my, I didn't pay rent. I didn't have to pay money for my food. I didn't have to worry about the house being cleaned. I didn't have to worry about my clothes being washed. It was a very cushy life for me.
Yeah.
Right? But I do know that I had friends who had come from other cities. They were living on their own. They had to take care of everything on their own.
Mm.
And teaching takes a lot out because you're in classroom for like 8-9 hours in a day. But to be in that class for 8-9 hours, you're prepping for at least 3-4 hours every day. On the weekends and all, we would prep constantly.
Mm.
I can't imagine how they did all of that and ran a household and cooked food and, you know, paid bills. I didn't have to worry about any of that.
Mm-hmm.
So no, I wouldn't, I don't think I could go back right now because I wouldn't have a steady source of income.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to maintain a certain type of a lifestyle. Maybe if I would love to do something like that, like part-time or something of that sort. But I think the money aspect is quite important because I wasn't born with, you know, that kind of a silver spoon. I'll be like, okay, yeah, chill.
Yeah.
I can do that. And like rent will just be automatically paid.
Interesting. Yeah, I have had some people on the pod who, yeah, I think work in this big umbrella of the development sector. And yeah, I think that's something nobody tells you when you get in that, yeah, you don't get paid. Yes, your work is probably very rewarding, but the lack of money is a challenging thing to deal with.
And I'm, you know, I always hear people say, oh, money doesn't matter. And in my head, I was like, the only people who say money doesn't matter are probably people who have a lot of it.
So do you say money doesn't matter these days, Anya?
No, I think money matters. I think money matters to maintain the lifestyle that you want.
Yeah.
I want to be able to go out for dinner and not worry about, oh, does this mean I won't have money for a rainy day tomorrow?
Mm.
right? I want to be able to take a holiday and not worry about, well, does that mean I have to take out of my rent fund? I want to be able to maintain that kind of a lifestyle.
Yeah.
Right? And I don't believe in that whole money doesn't matter. Mm. I think money is important, especially in today's day and age. Everything costs money. What is free now? Even water is not free.
Since we're talking about money, I think I've it's a very fascinating topic. I think possibly have spent a lot of time thinking about like money and the role it plays. I'm curious to know, what have you like realized, or is there something new you've realized about money, say in the last 3 or 4 years, when maybe you have a little more of it as compared to, you know, 10 years ago, apart from the fact that yes, money is important, and whoever says money is not important probably has enough of it. But has there been anything you have learned new about money and how you view it in your life?
Yes. So I think something that I've learned very new is that trade-off between money and time.
Mm.
Right. So when I started working at UST, and yeah, I was, what was I, 22, 24. I started working at 24. At that point, I was very focused. I was like, 3 years, I want to be ahead of what I'm doing. 5 years, 6 years, I want to be like at a VP level, partner level. I want to get there, right? Quickly, very quickly, I realized that the higher you go up in position, the more responsibilities you have, the more accountability you have, and the less time you have to enjoy those things, right? Like even when you're on vacation, you are at a point where you're like, oh, this deal needs to go and I need you to approve it. This has to be signed. I need you to sign it. You're never really off the clock.
Yeah.
At least that's the kind of corporate structure that I saw. And I remember both my parents are in the development field / education field. Neither of them comes from a corporate background. So I didn't get to see a lot of that growing up. My dad would finish work at 5 p.m. 5 p.m. he was home. There was no, he didn't even have a laptop at home. There was no bringing work home concept. So as a result, I don't take home work, right? Holiday was holiday. Yeah, if there's an emergency, it's fine. But there was never this question of, okay, I'm going on holiday, but I'll keep my phone next to me. Call me if there's anything.
Yeah.
So that's something I realized early on. And I very quickly pivoted from, I want to be top of my game, partner level, C level, to no. I want to be a little below that, where I have the authority and I have the responsibility and I feel like I'm successful at my job, but I also want the time to enjoy it. So I think when I say that definition or that trade-off between money and time changed for me, I think the better way of saying it is the definition of success changed for me.
Mm.
The definition of success for me was no longer, I want plenty of money and I want to do these things and I want to be this boss woman and all that.
Mm.
I don't know. Success to me is being really good at my job, but being able to say, I have done so much more outside of my job. Like I have a life outside of just work, you know, and being able to spend that time. So I think that changed that in the corporate world. I quickly figured that out. And I was like, nah, this is not who I am.
Do you remember the day that suddenly that bulb went off? Like did something happen?
I don't think it was a day. I think it was this growing realization that I just felt every time I saw someone at a VP or a C level just go on vacation. And like, it was just something that I was noticing a lot of. And I think 3-4 years in, I made a conscious decision that I don't want to be that ambitious where I don't have the chance to actually enjoy what I'm making. Like, I don't want to save for a rainy day and maybe not live to see a rainy day, you know? So it was just this small things that came up, and one fine day I was like, yeah, I think this feeling that I have is becoming louder and louder, and we're just going to stick to that. And I'd like to say that I've lived my life like that from when I've realized that.
Mm. Do you feel, you sometimes feel bad about maybe now not being very ambitious? Would you even say that you're not very ambitious?
No, I don't, because I don't think that I'm not ambitious. Mm. I think I'm very ambitious. I just think that my ambitions don't revolve just around the workplace.
Mm, I see.
And I've never fell back and regretted it and being like, oh, I wish I had done that.
Mm.
You know, so even when we were talking earlier about the Zilingo thing, and I was telling you, like, I was like, oh, wow, look at these guys. I think the co-founder was my age.
Yeah.
And I was like, look at how she's made like a go-getter thing. And like at one point I was like, wow, I wish I had thought of that and I had that drive, right? And then I remember thinking, yeah, but if you do that, Anya, then who's going to travel? Who's going to go to like chilled out sushi things? And who's going to go watch movies? You have to give up all of that. Yeah. Are you ready for that? And I was just like, no, I'm not willing to give up all of that. You know, like that's not important enough for me to give up. Yeah. You obviously have to give up some things. So I think I have these moments of doubt sometimes. And then I kind of look at it and be like, okay, but is there anything from your life that you are willing to give up? And I'm just like, yeah, not really. So let me just move past it.
Yeah. No, it's interesting because I feel, I think a lot of people in this cohort, in this age group now, I think, and maybe it's a post-pandemic phenomena, I think say similar kind of things, including myself. I think the pandemic maybe also was, weirdly enough, was a factor which, you know, a lot of people just lost their jobs. You suddenly felt that, you know, your work was very secure. You got a lot of meaning from work. And then all of that, you know, overnight just poof, went away. So maybe that sort of drove some of this. But yeah, there are these, but I would admit that sometimes I'm like, yes, I do feel I'm less ambitious purely like at work. Like, yes, I think you're right. I'm ambitious in how I would like my life to look like. But maybe I'm less ambitious in what my career should be. But yeah, there are days I feel a bit bad about it. I'm like, what happened? Like, you become this unambitious, lame person. But yeah, I don't know if other people...
But like, if you did that, then you wouldn't have time to sit and spend three hours on a Sunday talking to someone running a podcast. Because everybody only has 24 hours in a day. Like, I don't care whether you're rich, poor, 40 years old, 90 years old, 10 years old. You only have 24 hours in a day. So you have to give up something else to make up time for that.
Yeah that's true. I agree. But I think that's
And when you ask me, right, do you ever regret the ambition? Do you feel like you're not ambitious enough? No, because COVID was a thing, but I was like, you know, sometimes you feel like, at least I used to feel a lot of like imposter syndrome. Yeah. I work at a tech company. Mm-hmm. I have zero knowledge of basic technology. I did not know how to back up my iPhone. I had to ask someone yesterday, how do I create a shared photo album, right? But if you ask me now, I know how to have a basic conversation with somebody on GenAI, on Salesforce, on DevOps, DevSecOps, all of that. It's just stuff I've picked up along the way, right? So COVID was, so there's a little bit of this imposter syndrome where I'm like, okay, what am I doing? I'm way younger than most of the people that I'm leading. I don't come in from this background. I have zero idea how to code. Like, am I really like, you know, supposed to be in this room? COVID was a big eye opener because I was like, I still have my job. And COVID was a year where people were struggling. Yeah. People were losing jobs and, you know, revenue targets were down and all of that. I hit my revenue targets all 3 years of COVID. Mm. In fact, I overachieved them. So that was like, okay, I must be doing something right. And right now what I'm doing is I got promoted where I lead the second biggest account. I'm responsible for the second biggest account in the UK business unit. And I am the person who's in charge of the P&L, right? And so there's, whenever I have those situations of, oh, can I be more ambitious? I also like take a second to just be like, okay, but look at what you're doing, right? And look at the people who are there. And then it kind of puts things in perspective. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there are moments where, you know, those doubts creep in. Yeah. I'm like, especially now with Instagram and, you know, you're seeing everybody else's lives. And I know a lot of people see my life on Instagram and they reach out to me and like, how are you always living like this? And I'm like, if only you knew. I was like, you think you have doubts? I have doubts.
Oh man.
But yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about what you do. You after MBA, you joined this company called UST Global. You've been there for 8 years, seven to eight years now.
7 to 8 years.
Clearly, something seems to be going right, which is why you've been there for almost a decade. But maybe tell me a little bit
from both sides.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about like what the company is, what do you do, and then we'll maybe talk about why you've been there for so long.
Yeah. So the company at its heart is a tech company, like most Indian companies. They started off 20 years ago, you know, basic bread and butter was like, I feel like I'm giving a corporate spiel to a new client, but it's fine. I've
done this 100 times.
It's just flowing out now. So they started about 20 years ago, basic, you know, they were doing mobile application, web development and all of that. And then over the years, they've branched out into other sectors. Mm. So now we have a company that does specifically cybersecurity. We've got a company that focuses on data analytics, company that focuses on the marketing side of things, branding, UI, UX design, all of that. And now we've got an arm that does Gen AI, AR, VR, AI, ML, all of that stuff. So think of it as it's basically like our biggest competitors will be companies like an Infosys or a TCS or things like that. So it's one of those, it's one of those IT companies. They've got quite a big roster, a very big roster, in fact, and they're very under the ground. Like they're very quiet, very off the radar, not underground, off the radar. So I didn't even know of this company, and it just, it happened to land into my lap by chance while I was struggling to find a job after graduation. It's a Malayali company.
Oh, wow.
So it was, yeah.
Wait, this is an Indian company?
This is an Indian company, but they're headquartered in California. And they have one of the biggest campuses in Trivandrum. So if you go to Trivandrum, and if you ask someone, do you know USD? Everyone knows USD because they walk by the campuses. It's huge.
Oh my God. I looked at the website and I looked at the LinkedIn and I thought, first of all, I've never heard of this company, USD. I got a sense it's probably like a TCS campuses, but I thought it was like...
I'm not even joking. We actually have an office in Singapore.
Oh,
Singapore is one of our big centers. So now they've grown to about 45,000 people across some 25-30 countries. So in India, we have at least 10 centers. We've got one in Trivandrum, one in Kochi. Kerala is where they started because back then in the IT boom, everybody's going to Bangalore. These guys decided, no, we're going to stay in Trivandrum. So as a result, you get like a lot of Malayalis. So it's funny, I always tell my dad, like, you know, there are days where I'll send out an email and I'll be like, hey, can I get this? No response. You pick up the phone and get it up, please. on the way now, please. There are 5 minutes, you'll get it. Like, it's that as, like, there are days that I'm like, you get on a call and it's everybody's Malayali, which I think is good and bad. Like there's pros and cons to it, but it's one of those companies. Yeah. So what I do for them, when I joined, I was part of the internal consulting team. So it's this integrator team, which was directly reporting into the CEO. So basically his job was, I have all these accounts because you have account teams, right? Which are based for your clients. So for example, if Walmart is a client, there's an account team that goes for Walmart. If Boots, Walgreens is a client, you've got an account team for them. And then you've got your different functions. You've got your technology functions, your HR, your... work and all of that sourcing, which is across the board. The CEO was like, no, there's way too much silos happening, right? Everybody's running with their own thing. I'm not getting a sense of what's happening on the ground. So he created this group or this small team of people called the integrators, whose job was essentially to cut across that silos and give him a sense of what's actually happening on the ground. Because I think he felt like he wasn't getting a very realistic picture. And probably because, you know, it's a CEO. Nobody wants to go to a CEO and say, hey, we have a problem here. So that's how I joined the company. I did that role for about 2 years. So at that point, I worked specifically in the retail space. And my job involved a lot of travel. So all my dreams of wanting to be a consultant with Bain and McKinsey came very true there. I was on a flight every Monday to Thursday. I lived out of a suitcase. So I did that. Okay. Checked off the box and done. And then what happened was I was trying to find like other roles within the companies that I wanted to do. And there was this role called the client executive, where you meet with the clients. And I enjoyed that phase of the job. And I remember like a colleague of mine was going on maternity. So I said, can I like shadow you? Can I just get a sense of what you're doing? And my manager at that point said, why don't you shadow her? Because she's going on maternity soon. So you'll also get a sense of what's happening while she's here. And it'll also give her confidence because then you'll be there when she goes away. So she'll have a sense of, you know, okay, someone's there to take care of it. So that's how it started. I jumped into that. So at one point I was doing 50% sales, 50% integrator. And then, you know, the sales piece worked out. And then I jumped into 100% sales. And then when I first started, I was given the North American market of one of the biggest clients that we had. So I only handled the North and South American sides. And at that point, they were huge in the UK. I got that in, I think, 2017. And then from 2017 to 2021, 2022, we grew that to the point where we actually became the highest geo. As for all the four geos, even though, you know, the UK was where the brunt of the main account was set up. So then in 2023, my manager was like, because we were talking about this move and everything, right? So he was like, okay, why don't you come over here? And when I came over here, he basically said, you're taking over the entire account. So now I have people who help me support in the different regions. And at that point, I think when we started, we had two regions, which was the UK and then the US. Mm-hmm. And now we've got four established geos. Mm-hmm. And then a fifth one that we're trying to start. So it's a huge spread. So I've got about 650 to 700 people who work on my account. So
700 people? That's a factory.
It is, yeah.
I have to pause you. Explain to me, first of all, okay, there is this big account. We can't mention the name, but let's say for the sake of simplicity, it's like a Walmart. It's probably not that one, but maybe it is. Who knows?
Yeah.
But say it's like a Walmart, okay? So you guys essentially help these organizations.
It's not. Oh, it's not. Okay. Let me clarify. It's not Walmart. Okay.
So you guys, like, you know, like InfoSys, TCS, sort of more familiar names, you'll essentially help these large conglomerates build software and across multiple verticals,
correct,
you know, marketing, operations,
yeah,
la la la.
And
you started off with the account back in 2016, and that account was very, very small for y'all, and now that has grown to much, much, much bigger. And there are like 700 people in the organization who work just on servicing that big customer.
Correct.
Oh my God.
Correct.
That's fascinating.
So I am responsible for 700 people who are spread over, let's say, I have teams in Malaysia, I have teams in India, Costa Rica, Mexico, Switzerland. I think I have somebody in UAE, US, UK, Spain, Bulgaria. And I think we're starting off in the DACH regions as well. Yeah, so it's a lot, and it's about... for this year,
what do these guys do? Like, what do these people do? Are they all like software engineers? Are they just project managers? Like, who are these people?
So it depends. So some of them are program managers, right? Project managers. So what we do for the clients is we give them a bunch of options. So sometimes they just say, I just need a project manager. I just need your help in finding a project manager. So that's one aspect where you're providing them with resources. There are other aspects where a client will come back and say, I have this chunk of work that I need to be done. I have this product that I need to be built. It has to be built in a 6-month time period. Here is the scope. Here is the requirements. What's your pricing? Get it done. So in that case, I'm doing a fixed scope of work. And then there are clients who have products, right, that they send out to their end user clients. Now, those products have to be continuously built, upgraded, migrated from one environment to the other, whatever. So then I have teams who work with them on a longer term basis who are just churning that piece of work out. So there it's actually where we've built it to the point where it was actually something that we did last year, which was something we're very proud of. But we basically said, we have all these people working for you, right? Like, let's take out the people aspect. You tell me what you want. I will work out like a commercial proposition for you, whereby it's like a catalog. So you know that if a small size of this particular project comes, you already know how much it's going to cost you. So you can go and give your that pricing to your end clients. They say, yes, we want this. You come back, you say, this client, this is the requirements list. My team will build it. And then we'll test it. We'll build it, we'll test it, and we'll deploy it to your end user clients. And you just pocket the money. So your client is paying you.
I see.
You pay me. It's cheaper for you this way because it's less than, you know, when I was giving you resources. It's better for you this way because it's my neck on the line.
Yeah.
I have committed to you timelines. I have committed to you a quality check. You just sit back and chill.
Yeah.
And third is, you know, it also helps you put your time and the time of your resources into the new aspects. Like, this is stuff that my teams know how to do. We'll build that knowledge for you. So there is different ways. And now Gen AI is a big deal. So now we're having some conversations around that. So yeah, it's just, it's a little bit
You sound like a partner at a consulting firm. I'm just going to keep selling you the shit.
Yeah.
Here's one thing. Here's something more.
Here's something more. Yeah. No, I actually make it a very big point. I think I realized early on that a lot of people think, or the expectation of a salesperson is, this person is just going to pinko, right? They're just going to sell me. They're going to sell me this pen. This is a very common interview question. Sell me this pen. And then I read about this one person who, I think it was sell me this laptop or something. And I don't know if it was a true story or a joke or whatever, but basically this chap was told this. He took the laptop at home. Okay, then this guy calls him the next day saying, no, I know the laptop. Now you buy it from me. So he's like, I sold it to you. I did it. No, but when I think of sales, I think of it as being the gatekeeper to my clients. So like, obviously you have all these different segments in the market in my company, right? And they all want to get to my client because they want a revenue share. If, for example, if there's a project and that project is specifically around, say, UI UX, then the UI UX aspect of my team of my company will get a share of that revenue, right? So they're all trying to sell to you, and then you sell to your client, right? I look at myself as the gatekeeper of my clients. I'm like, I will not take this to them unless I think this is worth your time. So for every two things that I take to a client, there are probably 10 other things where I'm like, yeah, I don't think we're there yet, or I don't think this is something that's there. And I think mostly they say our salespeople will say yes to everything. I am very like, sorry, I cannot do this. I can do A, I can do B. I cannot do C and D for this reason. Because, you know, I want to be the kind of salesperson where my clients are like, we can talk to her because we trust her. We trust her to be very, very honest and very, very upfront with us. So I think I look at myself very differently from a lot of the salespeople. And I'm like, no, not everything is possible. I can't give you everything under the sun. It's possible, but there are certain principles or defining guidelines around that that you'd have to match around. So it does sound great. And I think this year my targets were about 35 mil overall. And I'm pretty sure that we're doing the targeting for next year right now. And I'm pretty sure that next year is probably going to be around that 40 to 45 range is what I'm expecting to be hit by. So it's a pretty big, you know, like when you ask me, like, do you feel like you're not ambitious enough? In my head, I'm like, nah, both come. But nice. Yeah.
What do you find hardest in your job today?
The people management aspect. I think just understanding that everybody's personality is different and everybody needs a different motivation. Like, I'm not the kind of person who needs to be given like a pat on the back every now and then. Like, I know by now, I know how my manager works. I think my manager probably gives me a pat on the back. Credit to him, he always gives me a pat on the back, but like, I don't expect that every time there is a thing, like, he's going to give me a pat on the back, right? Like, it's always, okay, you've done it, good, move on to the next. That's an expectation that he has from me. That's a standard that he holds me to. But now that I've taken over this role, I'm looking at all the different personalities and everybody reacts very differently. And I think one of the learnings that I had was to understand that not everybody would react the way I did. So I just assumed that, you know, okay, we're at an age where we're adults, we've been in this company, it's a professional organization. Like, I shouldn't have to keep telling you, great job, great job, great job, right? But I think there's different sets of people. Some need to be spoken a little more gently. Some need just time and effort and like a lot of backing. Some need you to do it for them the first couple of times. Just understanding that and altering my response to fit that has been, I think, something that I'm really learning to do right now. I think I'm getting better. I'm not 100% there, but I'm definitely a lot better now than I was like 4 months ago.
And how do you get better on this? Is it just like trial and error, or do you work with like a coach? Or
it's trial and error, and a lot of it is just getting feedback, right? Like, hey, what do you need from me? And I may not always agree with what they're saying. I may not always be like, okay, that makes sense. But just my reaction as a personality type is in fight or flight. I'm always fight. I don't think I'll ever choose flight. Even if it's a losing fight, I will fight for everything, right? But just getting that feedback and being like, okay, this is how you feel. How do I fix it? And this is where that knowledge that I had from PFI, I really hold on sometimes. Sometimes I just think back and I'm like, okay, Anya, like, if you were to deal with this in a PFI mindset, if you were not dealing with somebody who's older and more mature, if you were dealing with this as someone who's 9 years old, how would you change or alter your tone and your response, right? Like the words you use, how would you change that? And I've often stepped back to that and be like, okay, maybe I have to use a way softer approach there. That's where I've learned. A lot of it is feedback. A lot of it is my superiors and my mentors just being like, hey, this was said, it was probably not the right way to do it. The intent, understand, but alter that, right? And it's not always easy to hear because I'm also like doing so many things, right? But I really value that because I think I've always said that I can't fix a problem unless I know what the problem is. Like I am a problem solver. Like that's a big personality type, right? I'm not the creative person. I have zero creativity. I have creativity around like commercial engineering and things like that, right? I'm not the person who's thinking of like art and things like that. I'm not that person. I'm not the, you know, the one who's going out there and doing things and all of that. But I do have the ability to say, okay, we're going to make this happen. We'll fix the problem. So just understanding that, take the feedback as a way of saying this is the problem, helps me identify that. So I think it's just, that's why I said, like, I'm still learning. Like, I figured out how to work with all the different personalities now. But I'm still, I think there's a lot more that I need to do and can do in that space.
Well, as you think of the future, what are you most excited about these days?
Oh, well, I go on vacation in about 3 weeks. So I am so pumped for that. No, I think...
Where are you going on vacation?
I haven't decided yet. I just know that I've blocked that week off.
Wow.
I just know that I've blocked that week off. And because I have this long-term Schengen visa. So with that, you can just travel whenever you want because I already have it set. So I have to worry about that. No, what am I most excited about is just growing in this role. Like the whole point of this was, you know, how can I create that next level? What I don't want to be doing and what I was doing for the first 3 months was having to get involved in every little thing. Now I'm getting to a point where I'm like, these are things you should be able to solve. These are meetings you can take on your own. I don't need, these are decisions you can take on your own, right? So I'm very, very excited about creating that next level where I empower them to say that these are decisions you should take. Yeah, check in with me, but you don't need, you know, me to sit in this meeting or sit with this client. You know, if yes, it's a tough situation, figure it out on your own. But I think in order for me to build that next level and to say, okay, go solve this problem, I have to make them feel empowered enough to give them that confidence. There's that very thin line between giving somebody, like making them feel like, okay, you're behind them and you're backing them up, and giving them the freedom to just figure things out on their own. And I think just being more, right now I'm more like, okay, just shadow with me, sit with me, we'll figure it out together. But I do want to get to the point where I'm like, you know how to do this, you've got this, you don't need me for every small thing. That'll take a little bit of more time, I think. So I'm like, I'm excited about that one.
Do you work with a coach, like an executive coach?
I do not work with an executive coach, but my company does give us certain leadership trainings and modules every now and then. So I've attended a couple of them. And I take a lot of my learnings just from observing how do people talk in positions above me. So I report directly into the MD of the UK business unit, who's also the chief delivery officer. I'm always looking at how is he talking to me? When we're on a call and he's looping someone else, how is he looping them in? How is he talking to me when I've done something well? How is he talking to me when I've not done something well? Right? I think that's a very good indicator. I think, don't get me wrong, I think coaches and leadership sessions and all are great, but they all stop at the very theoretical side of things. In a practical situation, am I really thinking back? Like if I'm facing a problem right now, somebody calls me, there's a problem. I'm not really thinking back to, okay, in that leadership session, we had this one session, these are the tidbits. Like I'm thinking back to, okay, if my manager was here, how would he handle the situation? Right? So I think that's what calls out to me more, is just the practical aspects, the real life examples. So I spend a lot of time observing how the people around me, the good leaders around me, how do they interact with their teams? What is making them a good leader? Why do people feel comfortable reaching out to them, right? And I'm trying to just be a lot more of that without losing who I am as a personality. Because what I am as a personality is what's gotten me so far. I don't want to soften so much where I lose that aggressive shield. It's just, that's what I meant by just modifying based on the situation, based on the personality. I don't want to change who I am.
Interesting. Yeah, I think when I had a team, we had some sessions with like coaches.
Yeah.
And I personally thought it was like very, very, very valuable. Yeah, I think it is a bit theoretical maybe sometimes.
Yeah.
I think it depends on the coach. We cycled through two. One of them was average. The other one was very good.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's mostly just sort of understanding like yourself, how you behave in certain situations.
Yeah.
And reflecting. And yeah, for me, it helped a lot to... Yeah, just like very, very, very basic things. I think the one which comes to mind the strongest is that, you know, when you sort of deliver a message to somebody on your team, for the longest time, I was like, you know, my intention is good on what I'm saying, and I'm confident on that. But if somebody takes it the wrong way, it's not my fault, right?
Yeah.
Yes, sometimes maybe if my intention was not the right, then yes, it is my fault. But if my intention was right, and it was like, you know, tending to the right thing, then, you know, if you take it the wrong way, it's not, I don't fucking care, right? That's on you. But like through one of these sessions, they were like, hey, you know, you're actually responsible on how you communicate this and how they actually receive it. Because maybe what you're saying and what they're listening is not the same thing.
Yeah.
And that's just such a, like, if, for me, it was a very tiny thing. But now, like, I'm just much more conscious on, you know, when I say something, I'm like, did you hear it in the same tone and intent as I planned to?
Yeah.
And if not, like, you're not maybe to blame that much. I got to maybe change it. So, maybe sort of, I think if you have good managers, they do this for you. But I think I feel that beyond like when you're just managing a team, I think just getting a coach is a good investment.
No, 100%. I haven't gotten to that point yet because
700 is a big org.
Yeah. Like, it is. And when I have a coach, I have to give that time also. That's also time I have to give, right? But for me to give that coach time and make that time for myself, I probably have to take away time from the second management that I'm giving them right now. And we're not there yet. But at some point I will be like, I need a little help in terms of how do I keep them motivated? How do I keep it going? But you're absolutely right. Like in terms of, hey, I would take this message like this. If somebody came and said, Anya, I need to fix this. I'd be like, okay, cool. What do we need to fix? Somebody else might be very taken aback if I called up them and be like, you need to fix this. You're like, hi, hello, you know? So I did have to re-unlearn a lot of that. Like, I'm a very straight shooter. Like, tell me what's the problem, we'll fix it. Somebody else may be like, more, can you ease me into it? So that's what I mean by the people management. And every person is different. Like, the person that I have in the US would be very different from somebody else I've had in the UK. Even though everything else is the same, their backgrounds could be the same, their age could be the same, their, you know, cultural aspects, their education could all be the same. They just would probably view that information and take in that information on the delivery that I'm giving them very, very differently. So, it's a...
Talking about people who are different, I'm sure you're not the same person you were back in 2012.
Yeah.
As you look back at the last decade... Have there been any shifts in belief you've had? And by shift in belief, I mean something 2012 Anya would believe very strongly, but 2023 Anya feels very differently on.
I think 2012 Anya was, she had a plan in her head. We're going to do well in the 10th sport. We're going to go well in the 12th sport. We're going to get a Stephens. We're going to go TFR. We're going to do an MBA. We're going to get a job. We're going to get that C-level, corporate level, whatever it is, right? That plan. 2020 through Anya is a little more easygoing. What I mean by that is I still have a plan. I still know what I want to do. I think I'm a little less rigid about not sticking to the plan. What I mean by that is just in terms of career-wise, we talked about it. like personal relationship aside, right? Like 2012, Anya was like, okay, we're going to go this, we're going to get a job, we're going to get married, we're going to have babies, we're going to have a family, all of that. 2023, Anya is still chilling, still absolutely chilling. And doing a lot of things alone. So I think 2012 Anya was all about, yeah, I want to be financially independent. 2023 Anya is independent financially and in other aspects of life. Like I travel a lot and a lot of that has come from traveling alone. It just started off as something like that. And now I don't hesitate. I don't hesitate to do things alone. And just, I think the idea of, okay, I'm going to drop everything that I've known for the last 10 years of my life, all the friends, all the memories, all the routines that I've made, and I'm just going to move to a different continent by myself. I was just going to go and do it. I don't know if 2012 Anya would have done that. 2012 Anya would probably be like, I don't know. I don't know if we can. So I think those are the bigger differences. I think I've just grown. I haven't had, I don't know if you've had people say this, but I haven't really changed who I was as a person. Like that hasn't really happened. Like most people say, like, you're still the same person we knew back in college or back in Chennai or whatever. I haven't really changed much. I think I've just grown more into who I always was, if that makes sense. Like even now somebody's like, okay, you have to read a test. Like you have to study for a test. Like it's a scuba diving test. I studied so hard for that scuba diving test. So hard. And then I think on one of these snorkel, I think it was a snorkeling test, and they give you marks. And only once you cross those marks, you get to snorkel. Okay, so it's on the boat. Mm-hmm. And I think I got like 24 on 25 or 23 on 25 or something like that. Then I went and asked him, what did I make mistake? What was the one answer that I got wrong? Which is exactly how I was as a child, right? I want to know what was the mistake. So yeah, and I think 2023 Anya is a lot more confident about asking questions. I think if I went back to Stephen's now, I would probably have a conversation with Raghu outside of class. I'd probably muster the courage and be like, I'm struggling in your class. I'm not able to understand. What can I do to get better? Right? Can I lean on you? Is there something else I can do? I think just that imposter syndrome where at Stephen's, I was like, am I not smart enough to be here? Because like I used to feel that way at Stephen's the first year. I felt like, damn, maybe I'm not smart enough to be here, right? 2023 Anya would probably be like, I've worked my ass off to be here, but I'm not able to follow what's going on in your class. Like, what can I do? And I would muster up that courage. And my attitude now would be, I will ask him. The worst he'll say is, no, don't ask me again. Whereas I think back then I was like, no, how can I ask him? Like, you know, it's not okay. So I think that's probably who I've changed. I've become a lot more confident in myself and a lot more open to probing and asking questions and being like, why can't I do this? I used to be like that at home, but I think outside I was still a little more shy. But now I'm like, I'll ask anybody anything. Like, why can't we do this? Why are we doing this? Where are we going? Probably this happens to anybody. I think anybody, if you ask them in their 30s, they are so much more confident because they have experiences that they can tap into, that they can talk to, right? Yeah, I haven't ever coded in my life. I don't know a lot of what engineering is, but I have done so much else that I can speak to, right? I'm pretty sure you haven't done it. I was thinking about this the other day, like, you know how when you walk into a new room or like a new leadership thing, I used to hate this question. Like, tell us your name and one really cool fun fact about you. I used to hate this question. Hate it. Because I was like, what is a fun, cool fact about me? Like, what am I proud of telling people about, right? And I'm like, what do you tell people? Like, what do you say? I play squash. Like, that used to be my thing. I play squash. And then, like, half the people would be like, what is squash? And they'd be like, squash? Is that a game? Is that a vegetable? And I'd be like, this is really not working out for me. You know, but now, and this question used to be there in everything. Even if you did, like, a little discussion point, that was the introduction. You go on a tour group, that was the first introduction. Now when someone says on this side, like, I have so many things that I can tap into and say, right? So I think that just comes from having lived a life in the last 10 years. And I think no matter how you live it, whether you live it like me, shuffling around, whether you've, you know, stayed back, settled in, had a family, whether you've had a career, whether you just you know, done stuff like you, where you've built companies, had that entrepreneurial streak, like you have so much more value to add to that, just that one question now, which I used to hate. I was like, oh my God. But now I'm like, okay, fine, whatever. This is the question. I didn't have an answer.
Yeah, we have that in our company. Fun fact, nobody likes that question. It's just like,
oh my God, eyes rolling.
But yeah. As you look back, do you have what two pieces of advice would you have for 19-year-old Anya, who is just maybe entering Stephens?
19-year-old Anya who's entering into Stephens, I think the advice I would have is don't put so much pressure on yourself. Like, it'll work out. It'll be fine. And you don't, even if you don't, and that's what I meant by, like, I had that plan. I was like, going to go to Stephens. I was going to do really well in academics because I've done so well in academics so far. And I remember thinking, like, first year, second year, I was like, where am I going with this? Like, my marks are not where they should have been. Maybe thinking back, that was the kick I needed to just really step up in that third year. Maybe I was putting in less effort because I'd already checked out. So the only thing I would tell, I think the one thing I would tell 19-year-old Anya going back is just don't put so much pressure. Like, you'll find a way. You are resilient enough and you will find a way no matter what. You'll figure it out. Yeah, definitely that.
Okay.
Second thing would probably be like, eat more momos. You don't get them. Dude, I miss momos.
When's the last time you had one?
I had one 2 weeks ago, but I don't think they were very like authentic. And that sauce, you can get typical momos. You don't get that sauce anymore. So definitely eat more momos.
Well, next time somebody is visiting you, maybe they should carry some.
Delhi, yeah, carry momos and sauce.
It's not that hard to carry, but yeah, Nottingham is a bit off main London.
Yeah, it's a little off.
But if you're willing to make the hike, I'm sure you'll get there. Okay, as we wrap up, after all the quizzing I've done for you, you get to ask me one question. What do you have for me?
What have you gotten out of these podcasts? Like, have they been fulfilling for you? I mean, you've been doing them for a couple of months, couple of years now. What keeps you going with them?
I think in general they've been quite fun. I think it's just a very good excuse to reach out to people.
Yeah,
I think that's yeah, it's just a very good excuse to reach out to people. Otherwise, you know, everybody I think feels that, you know, they lose touch with people and it's a bit awkward to like reach out. So yeah, this is just like a good reason to reach out and gives me the license to ask people like anything I'd like to ask them, which maybe in a normal conversation like would be kind of awkward. So that's been quite nice. But I think leaving that aside, it has been quite interesting to see how, you know, I think people we went to college with are a bunch of like smart people doing pretty cool stuff in life, right? And yeah, we just happen to have that commonality of we all went to the same university, but yeah, we're different people doing different things in life. It's just very interesting to have these kind of conversations. A lot of the questions I ask people are questions I have on my mind, just seeing how, you know, they think about stuff, the reasons behind why they made certain decisions, the reasons behind, you know, like things which, you know, shifts of belief or advice they would have. I think it's, I find it quite fascinating because like a lot of these questions are questions in my mind. And yeah, sometimes, you know, in the people around, I have these conversations, but I think there is a certain, you know, depth in the relationship we had with people in college, and it allows you to, you know, get an honest answer. So that has been quite enriching. And lastly, I think I just like podcasting. Like if I could do this as a job wherein I get paid to just do this, maybe not all day, like doing this all day would be quite tiring, but if I get paid to just do this, and you know, it is a viable career for many people today. I just like that optionality. I'm very far away from making this like my job, but like I think it'd be so cool that if I could just do this for a living. I think those three reasons are what keep me going. Of course, for people who are hearing this, you'll realize this episode is out maybe after 3 months after the last one. So consistency has been on and off. Sometimes I just lose like motivation. I'm just like, oh, what is the point? Because the theme of this podcast is not the one which is going to reach hundreds of millions of people, right? A million people are not going to listen unless you become a celebrity, then maybe a million people might listen to this. But, you know, not like 100, 200, 300 people may listen to this. It's never going to become like one of those big podcasts. But it just sort of is a way for me to just like, I would say, brush my, keep my skills like brushed to keep doing this. Maybe someday I do a podcast with a different theme, which maybe has a little bit of a larger appeal, but maybe not. I don't know. I like podcasting. I want to keep it as an option. Maybe that, those are probably the three reasons why I keep doing this. And just like a body of work. Like if somebody ever wants to find Ruben on the internet, you would just find my podcast. And hopefully my podcast is, you know, around much after I actually am. So that thought is also quite cool. Like you'll probably hear my voice for hundreds of years, as long as Spotify doesn't delete me. But yeah, I'll be on the internet for hundreds of years.
That's quite. I was just thinking. I was like, wow, look at you, like leaving a little legacy behind. Like you.
I mean, I don't see it as a legacy
in your own small way.
Yeah, but like this is like a body of work where you know I'm quite proud, like leaving behind. So yeah, like they're very simple conversations, but yeah, I do envision like right now it's probably be like 71, and maybe you know if I can cross 100, that'd be a milestone. But say I die and I cross 1,000, that'd be quite cool. 1,000 hours, maybe more, of listening to Ruben on the internet for whoever wants to. I don't know who would want to, but for whoever wants to.
No, I think that's great. I think that's so great. Because I remember when you reached out, I was like, holy shit, I haven't spoken to him in so long. And it's not that I didn't think about you. I was like, oh, I'll reach out at some point. But I was just like, oh, wow, I finally get... Like, I thought of it the same way. I was like, yeah, it was an excuse for us to catch up. And
yeah,
us, like,
exactly.
See each other. And yeah, that's great. That's
a good podcast. Hopefully, I can keep at it. I think at the rate right now, I think I should keep at it. But I will slowly start maybe, I think, going beyond the Stephens community. There was a big question I had in mind on, you know, should it just be Stephens? Because right now, the audience also is a very Stephens connected audience. But I think as time progresses, I'm like, you know, I do this mainly for me. And there are people beyond Stephens who, you know, like Stephens is 10 years ago. Lots has happened in the last 10 years. So let's see. I don't know. The audience may not be the same, but I think I'll continue to stay excited about the pod. And people who have received messages from me, please reply. I really want to have you on the pod. Okay. I think that is that. It's been an hour and a half. Anya, for people who want to keep up with all the cool stuff you're doing and maybe want to reach out after all these years, how is the best way or where can people find you?
Instagram probably, or LinkedIn like you did. Usually if they're close enough to me, they usually have my phone number. That's something I'm okay with as well, but yeah, Instagram or LinkedIn would probably be the best way.
I'm not giving out anybody's phone numbers on this podcast, but you will find the Instagram and LinkedIn
handles. No, what I said was if they know me already, they probably have like my phone number, so they probably don't even need to like answer this question.
But you'll find her Instagram and LinkedIn. I reached out to her on LinkedIn and that works. So testimonial that is a successful way to reach out. Sometimes people's Instagrams, like mine, do not reach out to me on Ruben, my Instagram handle. I do not even have that account. I need to find my password, but you can always reach out to me on the podcast handle. But yeah, Anya's details will be in the show notes. I think that's a good place to wrap up. And that's a wrap. Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode. If you've enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review or just follow us on your podcast player. If you'd like to hear more from me, subscribe to our newsletter or follow us on Instagram. You can find all the links in the show notes. I upload new episodes every alternate week, and I'll see you next time. Thank you.